this is Mark Stein. Welcome. We are live around the planet. It is 5 p.m. Eastern Time in North America. That's 10 o'clock Greenwich Mean Time, 11 p.m. in Europe, the Midnight Express in Turkey. And my sense of what it is gets a little bit vaguer once we get Easter there, but it's something on Tuesday morning, and I hope it's not too early for our Asian and Aussie and Kiwi listeners. But all you got to do is use our comment form and shoot me a question, and I will try to get to it in the news of the day. It is a century exactly since General Allenby dismounted from his horse and walked through the Jaffa Gate to take Jerusalem formally from the Ottoman Empire. And I think I'm correct in saying that that was the last time a Western general took a major Muslim city until the fall of Baghdad in the Iraq War almost a century later. And on the whole, General Allenby's taking of Jerusalem worked out rather better than the taking of Baghdad did. His name, incredibly, is still all over the Middle East. The bridge between the West Bank, between the Arafat squat of the Palestinian Authority and Jordan, is still called the Allenby Bridge. I believe on the Jordanian side that they made an attempt to rename it the King Hussein Bridge, but I've never met anyone who actually refers to it by that. The Allenby Bridge across the Jordan. General Allenby led the Indian Army in their taking of Jerusalem 100 years ago, and almost 100 years to the day, everyone's going bananas because Trump chose to recognize reality and make Jerusalem the capital of Israel. And Allenby is said to have remarked privately that at last the Crusades are over. That's what he said on December 11th, 1917. It's not working out that way. A Bangladeshi beneficiary of chain migration attempted to self-detonate in the Port Authority bus terminal in New York today. He severely injured himself, and he injured other people, but not too seriously, so it's likely to be down the memory hole by tomorrow. And in fact, that's always, it's a bit like the Palmer's Green attack in London in that respect, that it'll people think now, unless it's like double-digit deaths, they just shrug it off as if it's entirely normal for commuters just to be non-life-threateningly injured when they arrive at the Port Authority bus terminal in the heart of Manhattan. And it shouldn't be normal, and we should stop mass Muslim immigration. I actually would be in favor of stopping mass immigration entirely. I don't see that it's needed in the Western world, but if you feel differently, then do ask a question on that subject, and I will try to get to it. Laura Rosen Cohen says, "I would love to hear your take on Swedenistan and what an utter pustule of festering and virulent Jew hatred it has become. Synagogues bombed, Jewish cemeteries attacked, and there are all of about 15,000 Jews in the entire country. Not a monumental community to protect if there was any will whatsoever. Do you think Sweden will beat France in becoming Europe's first officially Islamic state?" I think I'm on the record about this. I think a decade ago I said that Sweden would actually be the first formal Islamic emirate in Europe, and I think that's been borne out by events. If you haven't seen this, I won't say too much about Sweden because I'm scheduled to talk about this with Tucker Carlson on Fox News in a couple of hours. So I don't want to say too much about Sweden, but it is there was an extraordinary demonstration a couple of days ago that you would have thought was taking place in one of the crazier outposts of the Muslim world, and in fact it's taking place in Malmo, which has become one of the crazier outposts of the Muslim world. And you may recall that a few years ago a Davis Cup tennis match had to be played behind closed doors. No crowd, no audience. You know, if you like your tennis on TV and you watch Wimbledon or the US Open, And it doesn't matter whether they're playing on grass or whether they're playing on the artificial stuff. When you switch the TV on, there's generally people doing that swivel-headed thing as they follow the rallies from left to right to left to right to left to right, like Obama reading the prompter. And you didn't see that on this Davis Cup match because they had to shut the stadium and have no spectators at all because there were 10,000 demonstrators outside who objected to the fact that the Swedes had drawn in round one of the Davis Cup the Israeli team. And if my memory is right, I think at least one, or maybe even both of those tennis players were actually Arab Israelis. But it didn't matter. Everyone in Malmo still went bananas. And so extraordinarily, and you got to feel sorry, not just for the Israeli team, but for the Swedes. The Swedes are thinking, why couldn't we have drawn a less... The Swedish tennis players must have been thinking, why couldn't we have drawn a less controversial country to play at tennis, like Zimbabwe or North Korea? And instead they had to play Israel, which meant they had no spectators. There's no home team advantage because you're playing in a huge empty stadium because Malmo is such a festering sewer of Jew hatred that you can't actually have any Jews play in a tennis match and have normal people buy tickets and come and see them. Things have got worse. It's not just Jews. As I've mentioned before, I spoke to girls who were sexually abused at pop concerts all last summer in Sweden. I've spoken to women whose children were abused at swimming baths in Sweden. And we are watching. We are watching the most. And I read a really sad piece by my old Telegraph colleague Ed West in The Spectator the other day about how it's now normal at British Christmas fairs to see armed soldiers with machine guns at the ready outside a Christmas fair, because the diversity bollards, as they're called. They put the diversity bollards everywhere in case a car tries to get in and kill everybody. But you never know. The diversity bollards are still wide enough for some guy like the guy at Port Authority bus terminal this morning to try and get through with a pipe bomb or a nail bomb, or maybe just some guy who's taken the kitchen knife and wants to stab a bunch of people. So in a country where, until a couple of years ago, they didn't even have armed police, they now have soldiers with machine guns guarding Christmas fairs. It is a tragedy that is unfolding, and it's no comfort to those of us who warned about this thing a decade and a half ago, that a corrupt, diseased, depraved political class still can't even, and by that I mean the spineless British Prime Minister Theresa May, who keeps going on whenever a Muslim blows something up, keeps going on about how Muslims are victims of these terrorist attacks. And that's true. That's perfectly true. But so what? It doesn't make... Just simply because Muslims like blowing up Muslims as well as blowing up Christians and Jews and gays and women and pop concert goers and atheists and anyone, Hindus, Buddhists, simply because they are somewhat promiscuous in their targeting doesn't mean that you can get away with that kind of fatuous pap. What are you going to do about it to prevent things getting worse? It's difficult to talk about someone like Mrs. May, who, let us not forget, purports to be a conservative leader, without having complete and total contempt for her. What's your end game here? What are you going to do? Okay, you've got bollards around everything. You've got diversity bollards all over the Western world, except where it matters, at the perimeter of the Western world. Let's have another question. And John B. says, I enjoyed your article on Eric Campbell. Eric Campbell is the fellow who was the big heavy in the early Charlie Chaplin films and died in 1917 in a car crash. Amazingly tragic end to his life. And I was talking about that terrific Chaplin scene where... Eric Campbell is dining in a restaurant, and Chaplin comes and He calls the waiter for the bill, and Chaplin's the waiter, and Eric Campbell calls him over, and Chaplin works out the bill by looking at the food stains on Eric Campbell's shirt and concludes by fishing a bit of watermelon out of Eric Campbell's ear. And John B. points out that the explanation for the watermelon in Eric's ear is actually a very simple one, that a large slice of watermelon with sufficient diameter is one of the very few foods which might naturally finish up in the diner's ear as he ate his way into it. So if you think about it, it's a great visual joke, a huge slice of watermelon, the tips of which are sort of sticking in your ears, like a bit like the upside-down headphones that I'm wearing now. So I'm grateful for that explanation. Eric Campbell, the all-time greatest heavy of silent movies, and he died 100 years ago today, I believe, December 11th. So it was not just an historic day for General Allenby, but a sad one for Charlie Chaplin, who lost the all-time greatest heavy of silent pictures today. So we are going to take more of your questions. I've just lost the thing supplying me with questions, so that's terrific. I'll get on with it. Don't worry about it. We like to live dangerously here. I can easily busk for another 20 minutes, but we want to get to as many of your questions as possible, and we will do that. So let's see what we got. Let's see what we got going here. Can I find pull up a question? This one is from Drew. Drew says, Mark, on the campaign trail, Mr. Trump was one of the few politicians with the nerve to bring up the topic of birthright citizenship. When a woman can illegally enter the U.S., give birth to a child that is granted U.S. citizenship, this just leads to complications, e.g. cries that we cannot send the parents home without splitting the family. Seems this policy results in a large incentive to break U.S. immigration laws. I believe that the U.S. is one of the few countries that grants birthright citizenship and that the constitutional arguments supporting it are dubious. Seems now would be a good time for the country to make an educated deliberation on this topic, one way or the other, rather than just passively accept. Absolutely. They are constitutionally dubious, and most countries in the world do not have it. If you're born in Ireland, for example, you have to in order to get Irish citizenship, you have to, I believe, have a parent who is either an Irish or UK citizen, and that's the same in Australia and France and all kinds of other places. You can't just get off the plane, give birth, and have your kid be a citizen of that country. That's something that most countries would regard as preposterous, but not the United States. And as for the argument that, oh, you know, once you've had a baby here, okay, you're 8 months and 3 weeks pregnant, and you get off the plane at LAX or JFK, and you deliver your baby in an American hospital, and now your baby, you've given birth to an American citizen, so it would be horrible to split up the family by deporting you and sending you back to wherever you came from. U.S. immigration are one of the most cold-hearted bastards on the planet, to be frank, and they think nothing of splitting up children. There's a lady that I write about in my book, The Undocumented Mark Steyn. Dina Gilby, her husband died on 9/11. He worked in the World Trade Center. He got out of the tower when the plane hit, but then he went back in to rescue people. And he died there. He died there. Because U.S. immigration, the bozos at U.S. immigration, let in the people who killed him. On stupid, incomplete visa forms that said address in the United States, Holiday Inn, America. That's an accurate quote. You can look them up online. So having let in the people who killed her husband, U.S. immigration then adds insult to injury by sending Dina Gilby a form saying they're going to be deporting her. She's got children born in the United States. I wrote about that at the time, and And it appeared in the Daily Telegraph in Britain, and Tony Blair happened to see it and have to take it up personally with George W. Bush to intercede on behalf of Dena Gilbey. That's how heartless the bozos at US Immigration are willing to be when they really want to split up. It's not enough that your husband is a bazillion particles in the rubble of the World Trade Center. 2 weeks later, the stupid bureaucracy that couldn't actually keep those killers out of the country decides to deport the widow of one of the few heroes of the day. Birthright citizenship is a complete nonsense. And this idea that citizenship is just a matter of where you happen to be standing, you know, we live in a complicated world in which we have overthrown most of the basic premises of organized society in the last couple of generations. For example, on the subject of citizenship, it used to be, I mentioned Sweden, where ethnic Swedes will be outnumbered. They'll be a minority in their own country by mid-century. That's a state that was entirely homogeneously Swedish a generation back. And I miss the old days. I like to go to Sweden and see Swedes, and I like to go to Slovenia and see Slovenes, and I like to go to Papua and see Papuans, and I like to go to Tajikistan and see Tajiks. And it used to be that that was the natural assumption of people, that Scotland was the place where Scots were, and Tuvalu was the place where Tuvaluans were. And we used to take that as perfectly normal. And the United States was a slight exception to this, but again, it was it wasn't that much of an exception. The other settler nations of the British Empire, for example, Canada, until mid-20th century, was the British nation in North America. It had been settled by English, Scots, Irish and Welsh, and there was no pretense. My mother was a Belgian immigrant to Canada, but there was no pretense that Belgians had made as great a contribution to the building of Canada as Scots were. And that would be the same in Australia and New Zealand and elsewhere. And the United States wasn't that far apart from that. There was a survey done in the early 90s that found that half the people in America were descendants of people who were there by the time of the Declaration of Independence in 1776. So America's history had been of settlement from a very particular corner of the world. And then we suddenly got this ludicrous idea to sentimentalize immigration. We got this, oh, we've always been a nation of immigrants thing. And it worked so well for the America. It's such a great greeting card slogan. It sounds so nice. It sounds terrific when you chisel it on the bottom of the Statue of Liberty. It's a perfect, nice Hallmark card slogan. But it's a ludicrous sentimentalization of something we ought to be seriously hard-headed about, particularly when there are people self-detonating at Port Authority bus terminal. Extended family reunion is preposterous. Just because you've been admitted to a country, why the hell should your cousin get in or your grandparents? There shouldn't be any family reunification except for spouses and minor children. All the rest is a scam. Whereby, you know, one guy gets a visa and the entire village in Somalia, by chain migration, can wind up following him. It's a scam and you're the chumps of the planet for putting up with it. I think we're in a situation where chain migration and birthright citizenship, at the very minimum, they're the very minimum of what should be gotten rid of. That question came from Drew. Thank you for that question, Drew. delighted to have it. But by the way, before I forget, I mentioned I was going to be on Tucker in a couple of hours. But before that, I will also have another episode around about 7 o'clock Eastern, a couple of hours from now. We'll have another episode of our current Tale for Our Time, which is a seasonal one, which is Charles Dickens' Christmas Carol. So I do hope you'll join me for that. Let's have a look. What other questions? We got a couple of, you can probably tell, we got a couple of... here, Time Magazine, Raj from Canada, somewhere in the Dominion of Canada. He's a bit coy about that, but wherever it is, Raj says, Time Magazine has named 16-year-old Raouf Alumeidi as one of the most influential teens of 2017. Her achievement is the creation of a himoji. A hijab. It's like it's a hijab emoji. And do you know something? There is no idea. So I've said this on TV recently, and there is no idea so stupid that you can't actually put it past the multiculturalists. And I love this. I said on TV, I think I was on Fox and Friends, and I said, I was told years ago that the quickest way to make $1 million is to take the joke that makes you laugh the most and play it for real. And that's actually true in this case. A himoji, which is an emoji that's a hijab, and that's what the world's been waiting for, hasn't it? I mean, you know, what's the point? What else do we need? You know, I don't understand how. Do you know, people wonder why Time Magazine is dying, and I don't understand how they think that they can carry on. I mean, I don't understand how editor. The point about journalists was they used to be cynical. And instead now they're politically correct sentimentalists. And I don't understand how they can seriously have an editorial meeting and they don't actually just all laugh at this stuff. That they actually take it seriously and they don't all laugh at it, and it winds up becoming a thing. And they actually decide to make her, you know, one of the most influential teens of 2017. I'm trying to pull up on the internet, see if I can, this hijab emoji. I've got a bit of a problem with my internet connection here, but I'm going to see if I can pull it up and take a look at it. The hijabi. What's it called? Himoji. Himoji. Terrific. Himoji. Let me see. I'm typing live. What's it called? A hijabi or an hijabi? Yeah, the himoji. Yeah, terrific. Just what we've always wanted. Anyway, that's one of the most influential teens of the world is the person who's created this himoji. And we should all be celebrating, because it's, I don't know about you, but I've been, because it's very tiring, you know. For example, I was talking earlier about all the covered women in Sweden. It's so much easier if you can just actually have a little hijab emoji that you can type. That's terrific. That's what the world's been waiting for, a hijab emoji. Wonderful. Super duper. Can't wait for the next innovation. Maybe we can have a hijab scimitar, and that'll be everything we need. Anyway, let's have a look. I think we got the internet back here now. That's great. Mark, which one comes to a conclusion first, says Brian Leap, the Mueller investigation? Or actually, don't you find it odd? That's what I say we like about Sweden, but actually you can get pretty good internet almost anywhere there. It's like trying to do anything from northern New England. It's like Baghdad outside the green zone. Brian Leap says, Mark, which one comes to a conclusion first, the Mueller investigation or man's defamation suit against you? I know the lawsuit has been in the quagmire for 5 years now, but on the bright side, the longer it drags on, the better chance that SCOTUS is stacked with Trump nominees who believe in the First Amendment. Maybe. My view is that I'm not actually going to live to see that. And I mean that actually relatively seriously. I think the Michael Mann defamation suit was procedurally bollocksed by the District of Columbia court system, which is a disgraceful and incompetent court system. I don't live in the District of Columbia. I only go there to attend court. I voluntarily submitted to their jurisdiction on the careless assumption that the bonehead jurists of that dump were competent to actually try, as they were so eager to take the case, I assumed they were competent to try it. In fact, that is not actually so. And it will be, alas, my children who will have to. I think it'll be Michael E. Mann versus the estate of Mark Stein by the time that thing comes to trial, thanks to the incompetence of those guys. The Mueller investigation, I think Mueller has somewhat overplayed his hand. We have a corrupt FBI now, basically, that was in on the core of this whole investigation is this bogus dossier by Christopher Steele, this rogue MI6 agent. So that's the first foreigner. The Democrats and their associates and the Clinton campaign are colluding with a foreigner, this MI6 agent, Christopher Steele. He's colluding. He used to head the Russia desk at MI6. So he's not a small player here. That's a pretty big position. And he's colluding with his Russian counterparts to cook up all this dirt on Trump. The dossier winds up in the hands of the FBI. It's basically National Enquirer stuff. According to one report, there's actually some fan fiction in there, which is the dramatic bit about the micturition scene of Trump and the prostitutes supposedly in this hotel room on the bed that Obama had slept in. Supposedly some at any rate, this dossier is presented to the FBI, which then puts it in a form suitable to get a FISA warrant, enabling them to wiretap all Trump's associates. It seems to me this is obviously corrupt, and it seems to me it's deeply disturbing that the National Police Agency, the FBI, is corrupt. It seems to me deeply disturbing that they entrapped Flynn into so-called lying in an obviously fraudulent way. And in fact, they have no business as minor bureaucrats of the vast state in knowing what the incoming National Security Advisor said to the Russian ambassador. That ought to be a tightly held secret between a few key players at the top of the administration. So I'm fairly confident that Mueller's overplayed his hand, that actually this is a disgusting, corrupt, choked toilet of an investigation, and that it is going nowhere, and Mueller's best attempts to get it to go anywhere, including this ludicrous dossier that won't die, are not going to. And in fact, the real issue here is that we have the state and its bureaucracy wiretapping without just cause its political opponents. That's Banana Republic 101, and Americans should be man about it. Banana Republic 101. Let us have a question from Natalie Olson. Natalie is one of our younger members of the Mark Stein Club and says, Mr. Stein, I was wondering how you feel about Trump recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and what you think this means for Trump and tensions in the Middle East on the global level. Also, how do you feel about the rioting and attacks in Israel? Well, I don't feel anything about the rioting because I think this is just this is just kind of jihadist theatre. You know, when you round the corner almost anywhere in the Muslim world and there's a bunch of people torching, it's usually the American flag, sometimes the Israeli flag. At the time of the Danish cartoons, it was the Danish flag. God knows where you go about getting a Danish flag in the Muslim world at short notice because you want to set it alight in the street. My favourite was the guy in Lahore who was having a big demonstration. They were all dancing around the street doing the big death to the great Satan dance. I love it. I can do it. It's great. It's way more fun than the Macarena. So we're all doing the death to the great Satan dance. This guy in Lahore, he gets too close to the flag, and somehow the Americans, this is how cunning they are, they put something in the flag, and the fumes make him pass out, and he's taken to hospital, and he dies. This guy, he's completely blameless, innocent guy. He's just lighting up an American flag, doing, oh, dead to the great Satan. And he gets too close and he inhales the fumes, because the Americans, they're cunning. They put something in the flag, and the flag die. That makes you pass out and you die. And it's in the national anthem. What so proudly we inhale at the twilight's last gleaming. That's why everybody's taking a knee to it. It's dangerous to get too close to the flag when you light it up. It's, if you're thinking of burning the American flag, be careful. You don't want to end up like this poor guy in Lahore. He's dead about it. So I don't pay no attention to that. I like a bit of creativity. I'm bored when I see them torching the Star Spangled Banner, torching the Star of David, torching the Union Jack. I think it's nice that sometimes they get a little bit creative. They torch the Danish flag. Sometimes they get a bit confused, accidentally torch the Norwegian, Swedish, Finnish flag. It's hard. There's not a lot of flag specialists in the Muslim world. It's a big business to be in, by the way. If you've got the concession on exporting US and Israeli flags to the Muslim world, that's a gold mine because they're always looking for more flags to burn. Because nothing really gets the party off like torching an Israeli flag or torching an American flag. So it's just terrific. So I never worry about that, Natalie. Let them. But how I feel about Trump recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Look, he's not. People talk about this as if it's just some crazy thing. There was a cartoon, an absurd cartoon. I think it's in the Toronto. Is it the Toronto Sun or the Toronto Star this morning? As if it's just some crazy thing that Trump came. No, the government ministries are in Jerusalem. The head of state, the head of the Israeli state is in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the capital city of Israel. And it's basically since the Arabs launched another stupid war and wound up losing East Jerusalem. It's basically been under Israeli control for half a century. That's reality. You know, Canada, the Dominion of Canada is 150 years old. So 1867, July 1st, 1867. If in 1917, somebody was refusing to recognize Ottawa as the capital of Canada, you'd think he was a nut. If in, what are we talking about? 1776, July 4th, 1776. If in, say, 1826, the British were still refusing to recognize Washington as the capital of the United States of America, you'd say these guys are mentally ill. They're refusing to recognize reality. We're told that it could be damaging to the peace process. There isn't any peace process. There is nobody on the West Bank or in Gaza who wants to create a functioning Palestinian state. On the West Bank, they're basically the old school Arafat kleptocrats. They just want to steal and loot and kill Jews. And in Gaza, they're kind of hardcore Islamic supremacists who just want to stick you in a burqa and have Sharia law and kill Jews. So that's the only thing these two halves of the Palestinian state have in common, the Jew killing bit. Otherwise, they got no interest in creating a state. And it's fascinating because during the Cold War, the map was frozen. And since the end of the Cold War, basically everywhere that's wanted to have a country has wound up with a country. And I mentioned Slovenia a few minutes ago. They broke away from Yugoslavia. Slovakia broke away from the Czech Republic. Slavonia isn't yet an independent state, but it could be if it wanted to. Basically, anywhere on the map that wants to create a sovereign entity does so. And the exception are the Palestinians, because they're not interested. They're not in the state creating business. They're in the Jew killing business, and that's why it's a waste of time pretending there is a thing called a peace process. And I love it. I'm going back to what they're doing about jumping up and down the street, shouting death to the great Satan. You know, they get annoyed about weird things. But because Trump in 5-6 years' time is going to make the ambassador move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, they all go bananas. But they don't go bananas about any of the appalling misery and horror that Muslims inflict on Muslims across the map. They never burn anybody's flag for that. They never dance around in the street for that. And I'm tired of listening to them. Everybody you meet talented Palestinians all over the, you meet doctors and lawyers, all kinds of people from Palestine, from the old Palestinian mandate. Mandatory Palestine, all over the map. You meet them in Paris, you meet them in London, you meet them everywhere. Everyone who isn't a nut has gotten out of there. And what's left is some of the most dismal human capital on the planet. You certainly can't, there's no point pretending that a fraud and a kleptocrat like Abbas is worth trying to do any kind of peace. Oh, Raj has clarified it. Himoji is a term I coined, he said. This business about the hijab emoji, it's an emoji they can identify with. I'm going to have to look that up. What do you think of the Democrats purging their pervs from Congress, writes Scott Scherzer. Have they seen the error of their ways, or is it merely a pretense to defeat Roy Moore and impeach President Trump? I'll say this. I reprinted an old piece of mine that I wrote in the 90s about Bill Clinton. And I think up to that point, actually, the left was going full-scale war on women. Everything was rape. You know, I quote a bit that I mock about someone who argues that Beethoven's Ninth Symphony is like a coded version of rape, that it's the murderous cry of a frustrated rapist. Everything was rape in those days. If you walked across a campus and you said, hi, baby, you got a new haircut, looks great, they'd think that was rape. There was date rape, there was this rape, there was that rape. Everything was rape. Then Bill Clinton came along, and even rape wasn't rape. So nobody reported the Juanita Broderick thing. He raped Juanita Broderick, and he said, you might want to put some ice on that, as he was leaving, and he noticed her cut lip. And Lisa Myers from NBC told Juanita Broderick, when Juanita Broderick wondered why she'd given this interview and it hadn't aired, Lisa Myers reported back the official position of the NBC News division. The good news is you're credible. The bad news is you're very credible. Now, this is the news division that employed Matt Lauer, by the way. So they didn't run the story until after the impeachment trial had concluded and the Democrats had voted. And now we know that I'm interested too. Matt Lauer, according to the reports that have come out from what was going on at NBC, had non-consensual sex with a female subordinate in his office. Now, non-consensual sex with a female subordinate is what we used to call rape. She didn't want to do it, and he went and did it with her anyway. That's what we used to call rape. And as I said, it's very interesting. In the pre-Clinton era, everything was getting defined as rape. You know, if you took a girl out on a date and she had a couple of drinks too many, and you put your arm on her mohair sweater and let your hand slide up towards the more curvaceous bits, you were a rapist. That's how it was going. That's how it was going. Everything was rape. Then Bill Clinton came along, and even rape wasn't rape. So you notice that in the reporting of the Matt Lauer thing, there's these coy evasions as to what these guys are actually supposed to have done. If he had non-consensual sex with a female subordinate, that is what Democrats in the pre-Clinton era would have been calling rape. Now Clinton came along and derailed them. And I think they're getting to go full-scale war on women because it's basically the only thing that works for them. All the other stuff is just niche marketing. You know, in the end, you can make a big deal about gays and blacks, but they're minorities. And then you get to trans, and they're barely detectable minorities. But the war on women works for them, and I think they're planning to go full-scale on that. I think that is sincere. Whether Al Franken is willing to go along with it, I don't know. I wouldn't mind betting that if Roy Moore wins, Al Franken might be rethinking his resignation, which he hasn't given a date for. But they're serious about going full-scale war on women. And their line is going to be, we've cleaned up our act, but the Republicans haven't. So we'll see how that works out. Karen J. M. writes, I find it very disappointing that so few politicians and journalists who should be well-informed are knowledgeable about the history of the creation of the states of Israel and Transjordan in 1948, two states. The Arabs refused to accept Israel's existence. Thousands of Jews poured into Israel and were absorbed to become Israeli, no matter from where they came. Arabs who left the state of Israel were kept in refugee camps by their brethren in Arab countries. You discuss this very accurately on Tucker. Thank you for doing so. Well, it's interesting. After the I mentioned that this is really the day in which Ottoman rule symbolically collapsed in the Middle East. 100 years ago today, General Allenby marched into Jerusalem, and his Indian army put the Muslim members of the Indian army in charge of guarding the Muslim holy sites. And in the settlement of 1921, Britain and France carved up the map of the Middle East, and the League of Nations gave Britain this Palestinian mandate. And they had various, if you know your Lawrence of Arabia, you'll know that they had various Arab allies. And they took 55% of that Palestinian mandate, and they gave it to a Hashemite prince. And that became the Emirate of Transjordan, which is now the king, I think since 1946, the Kingdom of Jordan. So that was 55% of the so-called Palestinian homeland, so-called Mandatory Palestine, was carved off immediately for Transjordan. And that actually is, if you believe in such a thing as, quote, Palestinians, unquote, that is the Palestinian state. Then what was left in the 1940s, just before Israel, the state of Israel was born, there were even further discussions on how to leave the Jewish state as tiny a sliver as they could get it. At its narrowest point, Israel is narrower than my New Hampshire township. And it's still not small enough for the Arabs and the Muslims, because even a state that is narrower than a New Hampshire township is still too wide if it's all full of Jews. Baghdad, what's fascinating to me, Baghdad was the second most Jewish city in the Middle East. at the time that Allenby's Indian Army marched into it and took it from the Ottomans. And the reports of all the British officers are that the whole commercial life of the city was dependent on Jews. You can't find a Jew in Baghdad now. Even more shamefully, you can't find a Christian. Because the Christian community in Iraq was extinguished on America's watch. And we need to get serious about this. You know, people don't like Jews, okay, so we'll get rid of the Jews. People don't like gays, okay, so the Muslims get rid of the gays, big deal. People don't like this, that, and the other. They get rid of everything. Islam is king on a field of corpses. Where Islam rules, nothing else can breathe. And you can say, oh, Andalusia in the 7th century, oh, it was a beacon to the world. We're talking about, none of us get the choice about which millennium we live in. We're stuck in this one. So what matters is what this one is like. And I've been to Jewish cemeteries all over the Middle East. In my book, there's a big thing on the one in Tangiers, which is all rubble-strewn. There's chickens wandering. The graves are all smashed. The guy who supposedly looks after it hangs his laundry, drapes his long underwear over the graves. And I visited, to go back to where we started, when I talk about what's happening to Jews in Malmo in Sweden. And I went to the Jewish cemetery in Malmo, which is like a fortress. It's got this gate that's got these steel beams behind it. In other words, that in the event of a sort of car bomb, the car bomb wouldn't be able to smash through the gates and get there. And when I got in there, you know, it's a dying community, so there's not a lot of people visiting those graves. They're very nicely tended. But there's like Arab boys just kind of loafing around, goofing around, playing in there, because they're the future. And that cemetery in Malmo, beautifully tended by the dying Jewish community as it is at the moment, is going to be like the one in Tangiers. And as I said, people don't care about the Jews. People are very hard-hearted about the Jews. People, to go back to that, what that French ambassador said to my friend Barbara Emile just shortly after 9/11, the Jews cause all the trouble. All the trouble in the world comes from what he called that blanky little country, Israel. And like, there's a lot of people who think like that. But it doesn't matter, because as we've seen in Iraq, first the Jews go, then the Christians go. In the end, everything other than Islam goes. And that's true in Alexandria, and that's true in Tangiers, and that's true in Bethlehem as we get to this Christmas Eve. The de-Christianization of the birthplace of Christianity, you would think, is something that we would be concerned about. Jack Shaw writes, what will it take to get a proper unbiased review and vetting of the FBI and DOJ? Or is it possible? Why aren't the Republicans in the House and Senate demanding same? Yeah, I don't get this either. You know, Jeff Sessions was the first senator to back Trump. And if you talk to Trump supporters, there's been no bigger letdown than a man who just allowed himself to be gamed by the insiders from the first day he set foot in the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice was corrupt during the Obama era in that there was not equality before the law. And it remains corrupt now. And this is a corrupted investigation. And I would like to get a proper unbiased review of it. I would like to make one point, actually, which I think that ought to be given serious consideration. Right now, this guy, by the way, he shouldn't have been appointed Mueller because he was head of the FBI. So he's the fact, what was supposedly his big qualification, that he was a career FBI guy, is actually the reason why he should not have been appointed. A special counsel should, in fact, be special. The FBI director, Comey, should not have been able to get his predecessor, basically, in the role of special counsel. A special counsel should be special, which is why it shouldn't be a career FBI guy. But I'll say something else too. So far, he's just nailing people on process crimes. And process crimes are a racket in this system. Federal justice itself is a racket. As you know, I have a very low opinion of it and regard it as fundamentally corrupt. Because the standard operating procedure for federal justice when you're investigating anyone is you turn his deputy. I saw this with my friend Conrad Black, a rodent-like creature called David Radler, who was Conrad's longtime business partner. He was the number two. I forget their titles. I think Conrad was chairman of Hollinger International, and David Radler was president of Hollinger International. And so the first thing, the minute Conrad attracted the attention of the feds, the first thing they're going to do is put the squeeze on David Radler, and they turn him. And he wound up, instead of going to federal prison in Miami, he wound up doing a few months at some Canadian facility. I think it's an island, some kind of white-collar prison off the coast of British Columbia, where they have amateur theatre and horse riding, and it's delightful. It's what most Americans would call summer camp. So you say, well, what did you do in prison, David? He go, oh, I was the third gambler on the left in Guys and Dolls. It was great. And that's fundamentally corrupt, that system. They turn the number two, they turn the number three. That's what they're trying to do here. They use process crimes against them because there are so many. There are so many crimes that anybody is breaking at least 300 laws in the course of the day. So they only have to find one to get you on. And the easiest one to get you on is lying to the FBI, which isn't even a lie. And in the case of Flynn, they basically entrapped him. He didn't realize he was actually being... He was still working on the transition, and he thought these were guys coming over from the Justice Department in the course of liaising on various aspects of the transition. And instead, they entrap him. Now, these process crimes, everyone thinks it's very clever, like getting Al Capone on tax evasion. I don't think a special counsel should be in the business of process crimes. In other words, I think the special counsel ought to be only able to bring charges on the matter he's investigating. And if in the course of that he discovers that someone's committed a so-called process crime, that someone's lied to the FBI, or he discovers, that someone hasn't filed his 2013 tax return, that should go to a regular prosecutor in the Justice Department who decides whether it's worth bringing a case. But I'm sick of the corruption. This is a dirty, rotten, stinking, corrupt investigation by a dirty, rotten, stinking, corrupt Federal Bureau of Investigation and a dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt Department of Justice. And when you've got a corrupt Justice Department, that's basically, again, that's Banana Republic 101, and it needs to be cleaned out. I don't know what we do about the FBI. We may be getting to the point where we might as well just abolish it and start from scratch, because it's getting, we're getting to that stage. Alan Miller writes, don't you think it's unreasonable that Israel keeps the land it claimed by war in 1973? So we should have a worldwide rollback of all war gains since 1970. That also means that Turkey would have to comply with UN Resolution 353 and give back northern Cyprus to the Cypriot government. Israel could then rehouse all those angry Gazans and West Bank Palestinians in northern Cyprus, and maybe then they would stop complaining about everything. All problems solved. Yeah, you know... wars break out, and wars have consequences, to reprise Obama's line that elections have consequences. I personally, obviously, as a loyal subject of the crown, I think that the unpleasant events of the 1770s should not be recognized by the international community, and that the rogue government of the United States should pledge to return all that territory to Her Majesty. Just the original 13 colonies, the stuff they got in the Louisiana Purchase and Manifest Destiny across the continent, that's fine. But the 13 colonies, being the spoils of war, should be, you know. We can... Only Israel is subject to this nonsense. Only Israel is subject to this nonsense. And the fact of the matter is, if you want to push all the Jews into the sea, then go ahead and do it. But you tried doing it and you lost. So suck it up, losers. You know, we've had all kinds of huge population displacements in the last 70 years, not just in the aftermath of war in Europe, but also, for example, in Indian independence and the birth of the dominions of India and Pakistan and the population displacements that attended those. And it's horrific and chaotic. Everybody settles down and life goes on. And this is unique, where the Palestinians, so-called, are the only people on the planet who have a UN agency specifically there to maintain them frozen in aspic, preserved in aspic in 1948, where 1948 never ends. Everybody dies. You die. But your child becomes the UN refugee. You bequeath your 1948 aspic status to your child and your grandchild and your great-grandchild. What's it done? It's a disaster. And Trump, I don't know whether Trump declaring Jerusalem the capital of Israel and moving his embassy there is going to make any difference, but there is, but the whole stupid sewer festering unchanged is a big part of the problem, and anything novel we should be grateful for. Loretta says, "Dear Mark, it's nearly Christmas, my favourite holiday, holy day, and I'm reminiscing with great fondness over your show last year featuring Dame Siân Phillips and her performance of A Child's Christmas in Wales. What have you in store for this Christmas, and what could we founding members do to elicit more programming out of you? With great fondness and respect, Loretta." I love doing Christmas shows, as you know, and I was especially honored. I love working with Siân Phillips too, who is just a delightful person, and is prepared within an inch of her life and delivers a great performance. She was on our Frank Lesser centenary special, singing "See What the Boys in the Back Room Will Have" a couple of years ago, and Siân came back to do her "Child's Christmas in Wales" by Dylan Thomas. And Siân, I tell you what, instead of talking about it, I think we should, I'll make, because a lot of people haven't seen that, so I'll make a specific point, making sure that we put up Siân's performance of A Child's Christmas in Wales as a Christmas treat for those who haven't seen it. And if you're worried about the quality of my Dickens when I'm doing A Christmas Carol, you'll have no complaints about Siân Phillips' performance of A Child's Christmas in Wales. I think that's I would have loved to have done a full-scale brand new Christmas show, but we weren't able to do it. But I have done a little bitty thing for Christmas that we will get up in the days and put at Stein Online in the days before Christmas. Charles Morris, this is a good final question. "Hi, Mark. Would you agree that language like currencies can be devalued? With all due respect to the military and first responders, it would seem that one can be a hero by simply showing up. And any reference to an American is preceded by hard working. And with the F word having lost any of its historic shock value, is there any swear word that is considered today to be really out of bounds? Would welcome your thoughts on any of these," says Charlie. And I think that's right. I think that words eventually become cliches. As you say, if the minute you put hard working before American, if it becomes just like a routine expression, you do devalue it. Words are our currency, and you do devalue them when you do not take them seriously. I was introduced as a hero a couple of weeks back, and I won't. It wasn't a public event, so I won't go into too much detail. But I felt totally embarrassed because I had just followed a man who had given the most harrowing account of being in the most appalling situation in Afghanistan, where he'd basically been screwed over, as usual, by the parade generals safely back on the other side of the world, issuing absurd rules of engagement and putting these guys into a situation where they don't have the freedom and it had worked to do what's necessary. And it worked out pretty horribly for them, and he had lost a lot of his comrades. And he refused. He said he wasn't a hero. And he gave a powerful and impassioned speech about why he wasn't a hero. And he didn't want that word misapplied. Obviously, I'm kind of totally embarrassed then when some guy stands up and says, oh, here's a guy who's made a Cat album. He's one of the great heroes of our time. And it's completely absurd and stupid and embarrassing. But I want to go back to, you know, his point, which I think is right, that we actually ought to be parsimonious about handing out those words. And I think we ought to, and I think in part it's a bit like the "We Support Our Troops" bumper sticker. You know, big deal. You get a bumper sticker and you slap it on. You say, "We support our troops." It's one of the things that's come with the disconnect between soldiering as a professional career and what it used to be, which is just something that every healthy young man had to do, whether he wanted to do it or not. It was like an obligation of citizenship or nationality in pretty much every society through history. So there wasn't a big deal about being a soldier because, you know, you'd be sitting around working on the farm and you'd get a letter from the government and you'd have to go and sign up and you'd be in some dump on the other side of the world for a couple of years. And you were a soldier, you, and then you went back to farming, or then you went back to accountancy, or then you went back to whatever. And so our soldiery reflected the general population with all the virtues and flaws of the general population. And in a sense, we had a healthier, and we reserved the word hero for those who did extraordinary things. And I think it would be better to do that again. I don't mean that we should diminish service, but I would like to. I would like it if the mainstream media, in particular, gave more credit to genuine, extraordinary heroism. If you look at almost any American newspaper, the New York Times, the Washington Post, their military, they have very few military obituaries, and the ones they have are generally rubbish. There were great stories to be told there. And we should tell them. But I don't like the way we devalue language, which is a phenomenon of our time. And I don't like, and I agree with you that it's not just that the good words have lost their force, like hero, but all the bad words have, because in the age of Twitter, we just say F this and F that and drive like my compatriot, that Canadian porn actress driven to suicide, August Ames, I believe her name was, driven to suicide a couple of days ago just by the sort of cardboard warriors of the internet brandishing F words at her. And there's something tragic about that, but there's also something pathetic. These people are grunting, snarling morons who can't actually express a thought without the same handful of exhausted, bankrupt swear words. If that's all you got to say, it isn't good enough. You know, it is, WTF isn't really good enough. If that's, you know, that's the sign of a dis-evolving culture. And yes, you can devalue your currency, and language is our currency. And if you devalue it, You know, we're not Zimbabwe, but we're getting close to Weimar Republic territory in the way we've devalued our language. So thank you for that, Charlie. An interesting point. We will be back in about an hour with part four of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, and I will see you in a couple of hours on Tucker Carlson Tonight, where we'll be picking up the conversation where we left off on the state of Sweden and Islamic immigration to the West. That is it for this Clubland Q&A. We'll see you next time.